Blog Talk Radio.
This is Monica Leal welcoming you to the LL Research radio program In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert. Today is Friday, April 13th, 2012. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. Please visit our websites, llresearch.org, home to over 1,500 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, and more. And bringforth.org, that's bring, the number 4th.org, featuring forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. I will be asking Carla questions that come from you. If you would like to ask Carla a question live on the air, call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. Or join the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Monica Leal, and I'm talking with Carla L. Ruckert of LL Research. How you doing today, Carla?
Hey, Monica. I'm doing just fine. I am running, racing to catch up with spring. It's bursting around here so incredibly over before we even know it's begun. It's amazing.
Okay, fantastic. Well, we've already had it a while over here, and I've got this gargantuan tomato plant that was left over from last fall that survived the winter because we never even had a winter this year. Mm-hmm. It is huge. It looks like four tomato plants all joined together. I can't. It's just unbelievable. But anyway, it's a good problem to have. To, you know, lots of things blooming, and now I've got to go out and do some work out there. Yeah. But anyway, I understand Jim's going to join us today. Is that right?
I'm here.
Okay. Hello. Fantastic. Yes, we're so glad to have you.
Thank you.
Well, I guess I'm going to go ahead and start with the opening riff. Unless you had any quick announcements of any sort.
Can't think of a thing.
Okay. All right. We're going to do session 41, question 17. Questioner, then the animal in second density is composed of light, as are all things. What I'm trying to get at is the relationship between the light that the various bodies of the animal are created of, and the relationship of this to the energy centers which are active and the ones which are not active, and how this is linked with the logos. It is a difficult question to ask. Can you give me some kind of answer? I am Ra. The answer is to redirect your thought processes from any mechanical view of evolution. The will of the logos posits the potentials available to the evolving entity. The will of the entity, as it evolves, is the single measure of the rate and fastidiousness of the activation and balancing of the various energy centers. 41.18. Questioner, thank you. In the session from the day before yesterday, you mentioned the variable speed of rotation or activity of energy centers. What did you mean by that? I am Ra. Each energy center has a wide range of rotational speed, or, as you may see it more clearly in relation to color, brilliance. The more strongly the will of the entity concentrates upon and refines or purifies each energy center, the more brilliant or rotationally active each energy center will be. It is not necessary for the energy centers to be activated in order in the case of the self-aware entity. Thusly, entities may have extremely brilliant energy centers while being quite unbalanced in their violet ray aspect due to lack of attention paid to the totality of experience of the entity. The key to balance may then be seen in the unstudied, spontaneous, and honest response of entities towards experiences, thus using experience to the utmost, then applying the balancing exercises and achieving the proper attitude for the most purified spectrum of energy center manifestation in violet ray. This is why the brilliance or rotational speed of the energy centers is not considered above the balanced aspect or violet ray manifestation of an entity in regarding harvestability. For those entities which are unbalanced, especially as to the primary rays, will not be capable of sustaining the impact of the love and light of intelligent infinity to the extent necessary for harvest.
Thank you, Monica. I know that's a lot of words to hear all at one time, but in addition to the fact that one of the questions that I got in the mail this week had to do with the will, I picked this one because it is a common misconception, and it is so common that it deserves talking about, that you feel that you work with the lower energy centers, and then you're done, and then you can work with the higher energy centers. And although that may sound like a delightful plan for the foreseeable future, it's not the way things happen. We get out of balance in any day. We're here on Earth specifically to be jostled out of our comfort zones and to be challenged and to have to think about things and make new decisions as to what's right and what's wrong. So just because we cleared our lower energy centers yesterday means nothing about today. Today is its own animal. It's why Jim and I are so firm about the value of a morning offering. Jim, would you say that's one thing that we just can't do without?
That's true. It's a reminder that is invaluable to me to get the day started with the basic idea that all is one, and that as I go out into my daily round of activities, I'm going to be encountering the Creator wherever I go. And whatever I do is a service to the Creator, and I like to make each service the best that I can. So the morning offering is the way that really helps me to get started.
Yeah, it's harder later in the day. The later you give it, the harder it'll be to place your whole day on a spiritual level. But there's no quicker way to do it than simply to do what Jim and I did. We picked the things that we wanted to read and keep in mind. And we read a little bit every morning. We read from the Bible. We read from the raw material. Right now we're reading from the newest book that came out from us, the Aaron Kuo Dialogues. And we're reading a book on magic by Dion Fortune called The Middle Pillar. Very interesting book. And normally I would sing a hymn. I haven't been doing that lately, and so we've been entertained with several different versions of Row, Row, Row Your Boat from the inimitable James, who only has that one hymn in his in his kit bag. But it's a good song. At any rate, the hardest thing is to pull it back when you've lost it. So in order not to lose it, you know, the thing is, get your mind headed in the right direction from the very beginning. And it makes it that much easier every single time to pull yourself back and remind yourself as to who you are and what you're doing underneath all the details of the daily grind. You can't stay in the upper story dusting your Be Below and cutting fresh flowers for the windows forever. You have to clean the bathroom. You have to clean the bedroom. You have to clean the living room. You have to clean those elements of the life that intersect with other people's lives. And a lot of that is lower chakra stuff. The personal relations we have are all lower chakra. The birth relationships, marriage relationships, all of that is lower chakra. our work. So much of the important stuff that we do in life, the decisions that we make, all have to do with coming into the heart and being able to make that first great choice for love, that opening of the green ray the first time. You crank it open and you love and you dearly love and you know that you love and you just say, I am a creature of love. I love. That's what I am. That's what I do. And then, of course, you know, when you fall out of that vibration, it's a little bit easier to get back in. And, gosh, I've been playing that dance for, you know, as long as I've been alive, because I really can't hold a perfect setting for very long. It just doesn't happen that way. So I think it's really important to realize that we're not great because we're perfect at the lower rays or the upper rays or anything. We're great because we keep on trying, because we have the will and the faith to keep on behaving in such a way that we feel good about the way we act and we feel good about the way we live. So I just encourage everybody, don't get discouraged just because you're not a perfect person. You're living in a realm filled to the bursting with people just like you and me. Any thoughts?
Well, that's... Go ahead.
I just asked if you had any thoughts.
That brought up a question. In Ra's answer, they said it's not necessary for the energy centers to be activated in order in the case of the self-aware entity. So does that imply that if someone's not self-aware, it does matter? Or should people even be concerned about which... I know you talked about that before, about identifying which energy center may be out of balance. But do we need to be concerned about the order? Because don't we need to open up the green ray before working with the higher chakras, or should we even worry about that?
Well, I think we just need to look at where we are, and then from where we are, see how close we can come to opening our hearts. It depends, you know, so much depends on the moment, what there is in that moment. Being creative is a really challenging thing in some situations, but I think, you know, you have to try. But you can always just count on the fact that it's okay anyway.
Okay. Did you have anything to add to that, Jim? Or
No, I really am not sure about the comment that Ra made there about opening the energy centers in serial fashion. If one is not self-aware, I'm not sure about that at all. But I think that what Carla said did make sense to me, so I'm afraid I don't want to add to that.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking if they're not self-aware, they may not even know they have chakras. So open. Okay. Well, now I actually have a question myself regarding our conversation from a couple of weeks ago. There was that quote about the house being a living entity, and I was really intrigued by that. So I was wondering, do you think this applies to all homes or all buildings or only those that have been invested with a lot of love vibration? What do you think Ra meant about that? Does it have anything to do with the intensity of emotion that may have taken place in a home?
Yes.
Or do you think it's a pretty rare thing?
No, I think that places become identified or, you know, touched or brought alive, shall we say, animated by their interactions with the others in that place. If you cut up a board into the board feet that it had and you built yourself a house out of it, you'd have the residual awareness of the board, the tree. You know, the tree is raped, the pole is born. The pole is raped, the house is born, you know, have building. So you have a constant movement through to living this in that the element itself, what it was made out of, is alive. But the kind of liveness that they're talking about here is a kind that is involved in love. And there are lots of places that get a lot of love because of they're being treated as shrines or holy places, healing places, magical places. There are lots of natural stoneworks like Stonehenge that have caught the world's interest, I think, permanently. And it's rare to bring a house to life as opposed to bringing a dog to life, for sure, because the dog is far closer to you in his awareness. He's able to get up and move around and so forth. He just doesn't have self-awareness. So it's not such a huge step. For a house to become a home, it usually involves being in the same family for long enough for it to become my home, my beloved home, my family's home. There's, you know, some history there. And certainly all the very best ghosts belong in the very oldest houses. But there's always the potential for bringing a place or a building to life. And the potential skyrockets the more people are involved emotionally with that place or that thing.
So you're saying even a location can develop self-awareness like a dog could, or any higher 2D animal becoming self-aware that they are an entity.
That they're an entity that's loved. Right. That's the key is love. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, you definitely.
Well, that sure would.
All of the things in nature with a kiss.
Well, that would definitely explain a lot about these sacred sites like Stonehenge. I've been to a lot of those places in England and Scotland, and the stone circles and these ancient places. And yeah, there definitely seems to be a consciousness there for sure. Okay, our next question is from Abstraction. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's not quite spelled like that, but that's what it looks like. Okay, Abstraction says, I have often seen Ra pair will and faith together. Since we just had a lovely thread on faith, I thought it would be interesting to explore the notion of will. Here's the quote I was thinking about. Ra is speaking of the archetypes and the goal of their study. This is a quote from, now he doesn't give the number, but it's from book 4, page 194. We have been, with the questioner's aid, investigating the concept complexes of the great architecture of the archetypal mind. To more clearly grasp the nature, the process, and the purpose of archetypes, Ra provided a series of concept complexes. In no way whatsoever should we, as humble messengers of the one infinite creator, wish to place before the consideration of any mind-body-spirit complex which seeks its evolution the palest tint of the idea that these images are anything but a resource for working in the area of the development of the faith and the will. End quote. Now, I'm assuming that was a quote from Ra.
I think it is, yes.
Yes.
Okay, because it actually refers to Ra, so it may be a couple of things pieced together there. So Abstraction goes on to say, this part is just beautiful, so I thought I'd add it as it comes right after the above quote. Now here's a new quote. May we ask the student to look up from inward working to behold the glory, the might, the majesty, the mystery, and the peace of oneness. Let no consideration of bird or beast, darkness or light, shape or shadow, keep any which seeks from the general consideration of unity. End quote. Abstraction goes on to say, I'm thinking this is what Ra had in mind by faith, the deep recognition of oneness, as some of you pointed out. So I'd really like to hear your thoughts on this, on the meaning of will versus faith.
Okay. Well, I thought this was a very good question because it comes down to one of the fundamental words that are used by those of Ra when trying to describe the process of becoming a spiritually mature person. And they're talking about will and faith all the time. will, in excuse me, in the 28th session, the 13th question, Don was asking, is there any reason for some portions being much more efficient in learning? And Ra says, is there any reason for some to learn more quickly than others? Look, if you wish, to the function of the will, the attraction to the upward spiraling line of light. So the will is what is moving you on to where you haven't been yet. You have faith that it's there. But beyond that, there is an immediacy that you express as you call upon your will and set your intention that you are going to pursue this course with all of your will, all of your faith. And he goes on in 29 to ask, is it possible for you to tell me how an entity who has satisfactorily achieved the necessary violet ray qualification should use a crystal? And they said the gateway to intelligent infinity is based of, shall we say, a sympathetic vibration in a balanced state accompanying the will to serve and the will to seek. And those two, I think, really sum up what will is all about. You use your will to choose, as an act of will, that which you know to be the right, the highest, the best, and so forth. And if you have good balanced vibrations, you know, you've been doing your work well and you're coming to a situation clearly and seeing what needs to be seen and responding with compassion, then, you know, you're keeping that heart open and you're using your will to help yourself to do that. So will is that portion of who we are that can often be discouraged in young people because the need to bust systems that make no sense is very closely akin to the need to make thoroughgoing sense out of the life that you have. So, you know, if you're too good at taking what people tell you as a matter of authority, then you'll probably not get into the situation of being considered an outsider or a troublemaker or any of those things. But you truly do need to have that respect for the part of yourself that I guess you could consider is almost uncouth. It's rough. There's a grittiness to one who has an absolute determination to be the highest and best that he can be, or any, you know, to form the self after any desired way of being. And if you decide on that as a matter of will, and you set your goal to be like that, then you are helping yourself to exercise your will. And, you know, there's so many times that we have the chance to exercise that will. And if we can remember that the two wills, the will to serve and the will to seek, need to be held in a balanced state as we look at a situation, then we can more and more trust the solutions that our mind will call forth. You know, I've often referred to those times on the original Star Trek when they were trying to express the good and the bad in everybody, and one of the original ones indicated at the end that, you know, that without the setting of the self that was, you know, angry and violent and so forth, you couldn't make decisions. You couldn't stick to it, and that the grit of life was when you asked your ornery self to work with you for the highest good. And that ornery self is the one that has the most will. So you're working with a very strong entity, but an entity that, that needs to be talked to in its own way. And I think it's a matter of great art and skill to bring the la-di-da idealism of, you know, love, light, and oneness of all things right down into a life lived honestly and fairly in the midst of all kinds of evidence of the contrary being around. You know, if we choose to live by fourth density values and if we choose to see fourth density truths, then we can live in a whole different creation than one who makes different choices.
You touched upon this very thing, I guess it was last week or the week before, I'm not sure which, and I really, really appreciated the answer you gave and this further embellishment that you gave just now, because I'm seeing a lot of discussion about this on the forum in various threads regarding various topics, mm-hmm. and there seems to be a lot of confusion, or I'm perceiving it as confusion, I guess, about the place of will and choice, and how to balance that with this idea that there's no right and wrong and everything is all going to be fine in the end anyway. So sometimes there's kind of an attitude of, well, it doesn't matter what we do, you know. And I remember you said, I think it was last week, well, there is such a thing as right and wrong in the density we're in now. You know,
right.
Ra was talking about in sixth density, there's no such, you know, everything's been harmonized by that time. So how do you think choice fits in with all that? And what does it mean to live by fourth density values? And where does compassion fit into that?
Well, let's see. What does it mean to live by fourth density values? I think living by fourth density values means that you're living a life that is true to you and true to what you think, a life that tells the truth about you, and a life in which you have compassion that you bring to the table before you bring anything else. So that even if you're not very sharp and you don't get the situation, and in other ways people could call you a real fool, no one could fault you for being a positively oriented and loving person. But I think the more skilled that you are at being a combination of totally compassionate, soft and loving and comforting, and being wise. If you can combine those two, that will help the person that you're attempting to help, you, if you're giving yourself advice or somebody else, because it's easy to focus in on one thing and not take a look at the whole. I don't think there's any life in which this kind of choice-making doesn't figure. But I think living a fourth-density-oriented life means that you're taking it upon yourself to look at life as a spiritual concern. It's not a series of chores after which you get time off. A school of souls in which you are learning who you are, and the Creator is learning who it is. So we are on a fact-finding mission of a type, and it's the, I guess, the ultimate fact-finding mission ever. Jim, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, we all have the energies of our mind, our body, and our spirit that we can focus in certain ways. And I think the fourth density type of experience is where we focus on that which is unity. That which is not is separation. Specifically for fourth density, the experience that we're looking for is to respond to everything that we come in contact with love in one way or another. And we use our will to do this, to focus our energies, to focus our desires. And faith comes in here because it tells us there is a fruit or a product or a result that we are hoping for that is possible if we focus in such and such a way to intensify our desire to express love, to experience love, to give and to receive love. So I think that the energies that we have available for this seeking and the serving are focused by our will and enhanced and given a promise, shall we say, or a covenant by faith.
Okay. And thank you. That's very good. That answers that and brings up another question. One of the questions that came up recently in a discussion on the forum pertaining to this very same topic, and I don't recall the exact quote. I didn't look it up beforehand because I wasn't really... here it is. 15:14, okay, session 15, question 14, Ra said, the material for your understanding is the self, the mind-body-spirit complex. So how is that balanced with the fact that to choose 4D positive, to choose to be the path of service to others, we must obviously have love and compassion for others, which to me is saying, well, we want to focus on other people as well because we want to have love for them. And yet at the same time, Ra is saying the material for your understanding is the self. And could that be interpreted, I've seen that interpreted as, well, we don't really need to focus on others much. We just focus on yourself. So it seems a little paradoxical, and I was wondering if you might be able to reconcile that a little bit.
And the paradox would be between
how do you focus on self and balance that with love and compassion for others?
Oh. Well, you have to have love and compassion for yourself before you can have love and compassion for others, that's for sure. I know the big breakthrough for a lot of people in having a really rewarding spiritual life has been a real moment where they were for the first time able to say, yes, I'm unhappy. The little child in me has never been fulfilled. I feel hunger. I feel thirst for things that I don't have. And, you know, bring up those things that are uncomfortable and keep you from your comfort. It also keeps you aware. So, you know, the encouraging thing, I guess, is to get people to think of themselves and to focus upon knowing the fullness of the thoughts that they're thinking, you know, becoming more aware of the self. And for that matter, you only have the self, really. Everything else is an other self, which is like a mirror to you. So in some ways, the clearest images you ever get are right from yourself, as you see yourself for the first time in a certain behavior and see for the first time the real reason that you do it that way. Well, the real reason might have a lot of ego to it. You might want to get complimented for some aspect or another, or it might make you feel good to be in a certain role. You need to get, as you're using the self and as gently as you can, between and beneath and beyond all of the ways that we fool ourselves. I think that if there's a way to rationalize or to avoid thinking something all the way through, we're probably going to be pretty good at doing that because it's a lot easier to do that. It's a lot easier world if you're not really strict with yourself as far as your ethics. When you have a really demanding ethical set of rules for yourself, then it becomes more difficult to be, quote, the good girl or the good daughter or the good son or whatever. I think that there will always be this conflict between understanding the world by means of looking at the self and understanding the world by means of your relationship with others. I think that in terms of service, you're always going to want to talk about what you can do for other people, whether it's lightening the planet that you do because of who you are, or whether it's because of some outer gift that you give in teaching or healing or writing or whatever. Both ways of knowing more about the self are legitimate, and the one that probably will take you the furthest is the self, because other selves are just the self seen twice. Does that
and
make
all
any
of this,
sense at all, Monica, or you want to just take that from the beginning?
Actually, it does, presupposing that we're talking about someone who has already made the choice for the SDO pass. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Because I'm thinking, well, if someone hasn't made that choice yet, then when we're talking about self, that could be interpreted as the STS path, the service to self path. And just, in other words, too far focused in the other direction, then you've got the STS.
Right.
So this explanation you gave pretty much would apply for those who, where it's already pretty much a given that we have, you know, we've opened our hearts to where we do care about others, or if we see someone and, you know, we would naturally feel compassion for that person.
Yeah.
Okay. So you wouldn't, like, turn that off and say, oh, no, I can't feel compassion for that person because I just need to focus on self. I mean, we don't want to shut down that compassion, obviously.
No, not at all. Not to service others.
Okay.
I think it helps a lot when we deal with other people to realize that we share with them whatever we're seeing in them, that we are all things and that we are one with them. So when Ross says that we can use the self for personal evolution, I think that it refers to the fact that we do share these similarities, these identities, actually, so that as we interact with other people and we consider at the end of the day, perhaps, how our interaction went with somebody else, we can reflect back into our own selves and see that we have these qualities. We can have compassion for them because we see those qualities in ourselves. And this identity is always ongoing, and it's something that it kind of weaves a pattern, a thread between ourselves and others, and brings us together in realization of our unity as we reflect upon our interactions with other people.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Okay, to our listeners, you are listening to In the Now Q&A with Carla L. Ruckert. I'm your host, Monica Liao. We've also got Jim McCarty with us today. And if you would like to join us live, we would love to have you ask a question live on the air. You can call 645-595-2294. That's, you know what, correction, 646-595-2294. 646-595-2294. Be sure and press the 1 key if you'd like to join the show. I'm going to move to a question from Siren. Actually, Siren has a lot of questions that he or she posted on the forum, and I was just kind of looking at the Bring Forth forum to kind of get material for tonight's show, and I hit the jackpot. Siren has a bunch of questions here, and I think they're going to give us some good material for discussion. The first one, I've heard many, not just here in the forum, but I've heard many speak of third density as being an illusion, actually the illusion. If you think third density is an illusion, what do you think the rest of the vibratory light spectra densities are? And building upon the previous question, what do you think an illusion is?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think an illusion is a system of light or light love. Each variation in a vibration creates a different system, a different way of holding things in sort of a magnetic order within you. We are, for instance, made up of various organs, all of which have their own energy structures and who interact in a certain way in an energy structure. And so it's energy centers, energy fields within energy fields within energy fields. And we are dealing in any particular illusion with the system of light or light love that is controlling the experience that we're having now. Any experience that we have is an illusion. It's one of those little you know, it doesn't seem that it could be possible that it could be true, but it is. Anything that you can see is an illusion, because the illusion is involved in creating a system of light so that our physical apparatus can see same, so that we can see each other. So, you know, we're locked into a way of communicating with each other that completely has to do with illusion. And it's not that we ourselves are illusions, it's that the way we manifest is an illusion. In terms of essence, there's no illusion. We're quite real. In terms of being able to nail down this person within incarnation and say this is the whole of it, that would be more difficult to say, because you could nail me in this incarnation and there'd still be, I imagine, quite a few little bits and pieces out attempting to experience more according to the desire of the soul stream. So all of this bouncing about from illusion to illusion brings us through illusion to hopefully a more reasoned grasp of reality.
Now, by illusion, do you mean not real?
Well, by illusion, anything that's an illusion is by definition not real. Yeah. But the thing of it is, these illusions are real. We know these illusions are real. We're experiencing them. But are they real the way a dream is real, or are they real the way regular? Say, if we dream we're on a battlefield and we wake up, were we on a battlefield? Or were we only on the battlefield if our body responded to the bullets and indicated that it, you know, was part of it? And I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what the stuff of reality is in more complex illusions. But a simple illusion is just our lives. In order for us to be able to see and hear and taste and all of our other senses, we have to be within a certain type of body. We have to be within a certain very short range of temperatures. We have to have things set up pretty much for us. It has to be a human-friendly environment, or we just won't survive. We're very, you know, vulnerable. So I think that we have to face the fact that in accordance with our own history of science, in accordance with our own definitions and so forth, what we're looking at is a sustained illusion. And science will be the first to tell you that. They'll be the first to tell you that under a microscope all solidity falls away and so forth and so on.
It might be helpful to go back to the reason for the creation. The creator desired to know itself. So before there was a creation, there was the reality of unity. When the creator made a creation and created all this, what we see as planets and people and earth, wind, fire, and water, all of that, it's for the purpose of the creator knowing itself. And through this illusion and everyone that's in it, the creator begins to know itself in ways that were not possible before the illusions of the creation were made. So though things may be an illusion, it's an illusion with a purpose. And the purpose is to help the Creator know itself and to help us as portions of the Creator to know ourselves and the Creator. So we're all moving towards this realization by utilizing the illusion of the creation that has been made so the Creator can know itself.
Siren goes on to say, while we're at it, what is the veil? Do you think the veil is the illusion? I've heard many equate the illusion to the veil. And in a more technical question, how do you think the veil came into effect, and what does being veiled imply?
Well, veiling is simply the occasion that the Confederation took to put a veil of forgetting in between ourselves before birth and ourselves after birth. So in between incarnations, we can remember everything about all of our incarnations and all between incarnations and everything. But during incarnation, because of the fact that you want free will to be preserved, and you want yourself to make the choices that you make in a free way, you hide from yourself the totality of your experience, and you give yourself a, sort of a clean slate. One new incarnation equals a new slate, and you know only what you learn and deduce and induce from your living this lifetime. Occasionally, that veil is lifted for people, and it's always very interesting when that happens. And a lot more connections, a lot more unity, a lot more harmony is seen in the universe than would be seen without that kind of awareness. But for the most part, the veil is not the same thing as the illusion. The veil is simply that which causes one not to be able to recall anything that happened outside of this particular life.
And it keeps our actions within this incarnation more pure and more, shall we say, untainted by those memories, so that we have the chance to exercise original thoughts and new directions and learn new lessons and to do it more effectively, because we're operating sort of on our own hook. We're out there experiencing and exploring on our own, and we don't have the resources to call upon. We can call upon those resources, but we don't have them constantly in front of our face, so that we're required to go out there and to make choices and to experience events and to do this almost for the first time, so that it has more weight in the total mind-body-spirit complex.
Okay, you mentioned lifting of the veil. Siren's next question is, how do you think this happens? Progressively, as 3D moves into 4D, perhaps, as a natural result of increased awareness? Or do you suppose some external or outer higher mechanism is responsible for this?
Well, I think that it's a portion of the quarantine. Am I wrong in that, Nick?
Well, I think that originally the veil was put in place in order to speed the process of evolution, because in the third density, many—I don't know if you want to measure time in millions of years—but originally the mind-body-spirit was not a complex, and it took a long time to find a reason to move into new experience when you were totally sure that you were in unity with all things. There was no reason to look beyond this experience of unity. So the veil cut us off from that total knowledge of unity, and it made it possible for us, like I said before, to go out and to experience these things on our own hook. And the process of evolution became speeded up then when we were able to exercise our consciousness and to find a reason to have experience, to go out and experience what we see as a good and evil, and to make sense of it, because we didn't have this total knowledge of unity at our immediate disposal. We had to slowly work our way back to it, but in this slow working way back, it turned out that we were speeding up the process of evolution so that there was more of an opportunity for the creator to know itself by speeding up the third density experience.
Well, I like that explanation. That works. Now, you said we weren't mind-body-spirit complex before. So if we weren't a complex, what were we then?
We were simply unity, in unity with all things. There was only the experience of love and compassion for all beings, because we realized we were all one together. And though this is what we seek now within this third density, at that time or that experience, it was a very slow process, and there was very little progress made in the overall progression through the densities because of this total experience of unity and total knowledge of unity in the third density. We were not complex beings. We were simply one.
Okay, so we were differentiated entities.
Right.
But our
experience of each other and the way we looked at each other was of seeing the Creator in all beings. So there was no reason to have any kind of other experience than unity. There was no reason for any conflict to bring us out of that unity and therefore get new experience that we would eventually resolve and balance and grow from and have this fruit of the experience to offer to the Creator as a way of knowing itself.
I think that as the archetypical mind matures, there came to be not just the mind and the body, but the mind, body, and spirit, and it became a complex. But the first, several times, who knows how many, hundreds, thousands, million times that this pattern was run through in the creation, I think we started out with, wasn't it nine archetypes?
Right.
Three in each of the mind, body, and spirit.
Right.
So it was a long time to achieve the archetypal mind that we have now, which is a fairly complex archetypal mind.
And this is only pertaining to our logos, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And does every planet, as part of this system, have a veil, or is that just unique to Earth?
I believe it's a situation that exists for all planets. Don questioned about the primal logos of each what we call galactic system, that as you were closer to the core, it was more likely that there was not the experience of the veil, and as you moved out, an experience was gained that it was seen that there could be a more rapid movement through the densities if there was a veil placed between the conscious and subconscious minds in the third density experience, so that as we move out further from the central sun or central logos that creates each galaxy, that there was a product of experience that saw that it would be enhancing the evolutionary process to place this veil between the conscious and subconscious minds, because then it would once again require that the entity exercise its consciousness and have experiences that wouldn't be possible if the entity simply rested in that total unity that is possible without the veil.
So we've got the veil, but then we've also got this quarantine, which they're related but not exactly the same thing, because a lot of other planets, may be veiled, but they might not be quarantined.
Right.
Am I right?
I think so.
We have a quarantine because there has been some, as Carla would say, some diddling with the populations of our planet. And the changes that Yahweh made and some of the Orion group has attempted to make affected the experience or the exercise of free will. So the quarantine is for the purpose of allowing our free will to operate more effectively and not be influenced by what we would call entities from higher densities taking part in our experience here on the planet. So the quarantine keeps our experience more pure and allows us a more exercise of free will.
So are you saying the quarantine is basically to keep us safe from more diddling?
Right.
Yeah, right.
Okay, that's reassuring.
No more diddling for humans.
Are we any closer to rejoining the time lateral, do you think?
Yes.
Or
I think we're well on our way.
At which time the quarantine will be lifted, right?
That's right.
Okay. Okay. Do you know if was Ra's civilization veiled on Venus?
Yes. They had the same type of experience that we did, except they were more effective at achieving that which they sought, which was the experience of giving and receiving love to all those about them. They didn't have, they weren't a planet like ours that had so many repeaters. We have civilization from 16 different planets here that have already gone through the third density experience and have not made graduation and have had to repeat. So on our planet, we've got a lot of repeaters. On Ra's Venus, they did not have that experience. So they were a planet that was more successful in achieving the goal of at least 51% experiencing the love and light in every experience that they had with other entities.
And without all the violence that we have here.
Yes, apparently so.
Okay. Well, we are actually just about out of time. Do either of you have any quick last comments to make?
Let's see. I wanted to thank the volunteer who heard last week that Toby Wheelock was looking for a volunteer to help him finish his re-listening project. They called. They're in good correspondence, and we have a new volunteer to help Toby finish that project. I want to thank you all for listening and responding, and please, you know, write in your questions and any concerns that you might have, or anybody that you'd like to hear us talk to besides me or Jim. Give us a clue as to what you'd like to hear and what you'd like to see, and we'll do our best to help.
Okay.
Well, there was one that came in. Somebody said, could you tell us a little bit of something about what is love? What is love, the coloring book, come about? And I can imagine that would be a question that would naturally come to mind. You're sitting there looking, well, let's see, what do they have to offer? Let's see, yeah, okay, that's spiritual. Yeah, I understand that's metaphysical. Yes, I see. Now, a coloring book? Where'd that come from? Okay, here's the story on that. It was about 1975. And Tom Flaherty and his wife Elaine had a 7-year-old named Michael, and Michael decided he wanted to come to a meditation and he wanted to ask a question. So 7-year-old Michael came to our meditation, sitting in the big circle with the big people, and I think he was talking to Hatan, and Hatan asked if there was a question, and Michael said, in his 7-year-old lilt, he said, Hatan, what is love? And Hatan proceeded to talk about what love was. When I got the transcript done, I read it over, and it just seemed like the perfect text for a coloring book for children on a metaphysical subject of love, because it really did move your mind into spiritual love. So we were fortunate enough at the time to have coming to our meetings a gal that made her living drawing cartoons for educational people, like in textbooks and in cartoons for people to learn stuff anyway. She said that she'd be glad to do the pictures for us for a coloring book, and she did a beautiful job. There were about 30 pictures, weren't there?
Right.
Yeah, and so she offered up the pictures, and we offered up the text, and we matched it all together and came up with What is Love, a coloring book. And the channeling involved is not word for word because I had to take too much out, but it's part of, it's the heart of the channeling that you can look up on our website and read. And we're grateful forever to the Flahertys, Tom and Elaine and Michael.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for sharing that story, Carla.
Yeah,
I'm glad you remembered that question. Okay. And I think we're no longer on the air, but we are still recording. So I'm going to go ahead and let everybody know how they can find our websites, llresearch.org, which is LL Research's archive website, home to over 1,500 channeling transcripts, publications, The Law of One, interviews, speeches, and more, and bringforth.org, which is our community website featuring forums, blogs, and chat rooms. Thanks so much for listening. Special thank you to those who submitted questions, and for those who didn't, please do so. If you'd like to submit a question, please go to bringforth.org and go to the miscellaneous section and post to the thread, Q&A with Carla L. Ruckert, submitting questions. Thank you, everyone. Have a great week. We will be here next Friday, April 20th at 8 p.m. Eastern.